Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to your host, Ms. Monica Allen of NOAA Communications. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for your perseverance. I'm really sorry that we had this glitch, this technical glitch, but I'm very glad that you are able to be on the line right now. So we're going to be having the Great Lakes Water Levels press briefing, and my name is Monica Allen, and I'm from NOAA Communications. If you want to follow along with our speakers today, we do have slides that are online, and I will read you the short link if you'd like to get those if you're in front of a computer and don't already have them. The short link to the slides for our speakers today is http://go.usa.gov/F(Frank), the number 2, capital K as kill, and G as in go. On the call today with me will be, and I will spell the names of each of our experts, Debbie Lee, the new director of NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, Stephen Gill, a scientist with NOAA's Center for Operational and Oceanographic Products and Services here in Silver Spring, Drew Grunewald, a hydrologist with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, and I said I was going to spell the names, and Debbie Lees is L-E-E, Stephen is with a P-H, and the last name is G-I-L-L, and Drew is G-R-O-N-E-W-O-L-D, and Keith Kompoltowitz, who is the Chief of Watershed Hydrology for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Detroit District, and Keith's first name is spelled in the typical way. His last name is K-O-M-P-O-L-T-O-W-I-C-Z. And finally, James Noel, N-O-E-L, of NOAA's National Weather Service, Ohio River Forecasting Center, will also be on the line to answer questions. We will have brief presentations, and then we will open up to questions from the working press. Now I'd like to turn this over to Debbie Lee, the director of Great Lakes Research Lab.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you, everybody, for participating in today's media event. It's my pleasure to help host on behalf of NOAA and our federal partners. My name is Deborah Lee, as Monica mentioned, and I'm the new director of the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. I have over 27 years' experience in water resources management with NOAA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Understanding and predicting changes in Great Lakes water levels are important because water level fluctuations have a profound impact on commercial shipping, shoreline development, hydropower generation, and recreation activities, ultimately affecting the regional economy. Understanding water level changes requires understanding the entire water budget, which includes rainfall on the lake's watersheds and directly on the lakes themselves, snowfall, snowmelt, and lake ice cover, and water evaporated from the lakes driven by air and water temperatures and the wind. Because we share the Great Lakes with Canada, and because the water balance of the lakes is complex, understanding and predicting water level changes requires a collaborative effort between Canada and the United States, our respective federal agencies, and even different line offices within those agencies. The group assembled here today represents just a sampling of those involved, the Detroit District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and three of NOAA's line offices, including the National Ocean Service, Oceanic and Atmospheric Research, and the National Weather Service. The need to collaborate was recognized more than half a century ago with the formation of the Coordinating Committee on Great Lakes Basic Hydraulic and Hydrologic Data in 1953. Since then, the binational, multi-agency group has met routinely to develop Great Lakes water data and foster research to operations to improve water level predictions. So now, let me turn it over to Stephen Gill, who will tell you how we measure water levels.
I'm the senior scientist with the group in NOAA that operates and maintains the NOAA Water Level Observing System in the Great Lakes, as well as all of the U.S. I've been with NOAA about almost 40 years now. in the Great Lakes is one of our most important components for our national water level observing system. So between the U.S. and Canada, we continue to operate and maintain a fairly robust network of water level stations, from which you'll be seeing some of the derived data and products from these systems today as we move along. There are 87 U.S. and Canadian permanent water level stations providing continuous year-round water level data, 53 stations in the U.S. and 34 in Canada. 24 of these stations also have co-located meteorological sensors, and 22 have continuous GPS sensors for measuring vertical rates of vertical land motion. And that's becoming important in the Great Lakes as the isostatic rebound, the rebound of the land in the Great Lakes and the subsidence in the lower lakes is affecting the hydraulic flow of the lakes over time. So it's important we measure that. There are also many other observing networks in the Great Lakes, other than the ones we're highlighting today for water levels, including meteorological systems operated by NWS in Canada, other water level stations operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the U.S. Geological Survey. We also, at present, my agency is also operating three current meters, continuously operating current meters in the Great Lakes, one on the Maumee River and one on the Cuyahoga River, mainly for navigation purposes, for supportive navigation, and also operating continuous current meter, measuring surface currents on the upper St. Clair River current meter near the Blue Water Bridge. That's for monitoring water flows as well as for navigation purposes. So that's a preview of the water level networks. I'd like to turn it over now to Drew Grunewald, who will be looking at the data themselves.
Thank you, Steve. Again, this is Drew Grunewald talking from NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. And to build upon Stephen's introduction about the water level monitoring network, one of the places we start when we talk about the recent surge in Great Lakes water levels is to look at the historical record for a bit of context. For those of you looking at the slide deck, I'm referring to slide number 5, which shows the long-term historical record of annual average water levels on the Great Lakes. And there's two take-home messages from this particular image that shows each of the four Great Lakes systems, starting at the top with Lake Superior, going all the way down through Lake Ontario. One of those points is that we have a very long record with water level measurements on each of the lakes dating back into the mid-1800s. But the second and perhaps more important point is that that record demonstrates significant interannual variability across the lake systems. For example, on the Lake Michigan Huron system, in the mid-1960s, water levels hit record lows. They then rose by about 5 feet to hit highs in the mid-1980s. And then descended again, ultimately into the late 1990s, where they hit near record lows, and importantly, set the stage for a 15-year period of below average water levels on the Lake Michigan Huron and on the Lake Superior system that just recently came to an end. On the next slide, which is slide number 6, I'm showing an image of seasonal water levels, or month-to-month water levels on the Great Lakes. The point of this particular image and this part of the story is to indicate that there's not only long-term interannual variability, but there's also significant seasonal water level variability on all the lakes. Typically, water levels rise in the spring, they peak in the summertime, and they typically decline in the fall. And each one of those components of the seasonal rise and decline correspond with similar changes in the major drivers of Great Lakes water levels, which include regional precipitation both on the lakes and that propagates into runoff, as well as over lake evaporation. So the next slide that I have is slide number 7, which brings us to the present, which looks at the water level surge on the Great Lakes over the past 2 years and puts it into a historical context. What we found is that starting in January of 2013, both Lake Superior and Lake Michigan Huron have had net gains in water levels that have either equaled or surpassed any water level gain for the same 23-month period starting in January. So specifically, Lake Superior rose from January 2013 through November 2014 about 2.3 feet, whereas Lake Michigan Huron from January 2013 through November 2014 has risen around 3.2 feet. The next important thing to pass along as part of the story is the way in which that water level rise occurred. One important point to make on that also is, as I mentioned earlier, is this essentially brings to an end this period of 15-year below average water levels, and as my colleague Keith Kompaltowicz will talk about more in a minute, it becomes difficult for us to predict whether or not water levels might drop again, stay at this level, or go higher. But it is true that water levels on all the lakes are now above average for the first time since the late 1990s. When we look closely at the water level rises over the past 2 years on Superior, Michigan, Huron, it's interesting to point out that much of that rise or that net gain in water levels comes from a combination of significant water level increases in the springtime on both of the lake systems. So put more specifically, in the spring of 2013 and the spring of 2014, we saw above average water level rises on both Superior and Michigan Huron. And then what's also interesting is that on the Lake Michigan Huron system, we saw not only below average declines in the fall of both years, but interestingly, on Lake Michigan Huron, over the past 4 months of the fall season, we've actually seen a consistent rise in Lake Michigan Huron water levels, and that is something that is very unusual for this time of year. With that, I'll turn things over to my colleague Keith Kompaltowicz to talk a little bit more.
All right, great. Thanks, Drew. Again, my name is Keith Kompaltowicz, and I'll spell my last name. Again, it's K-O, M as in Mike, P as in Paul, O-L, T as in Tim, O-W-I-C-Z, and I'm the chief of the Watershed Hydrology Branch for the Corps of Engineers Detroit District. The Corps in Detroit spends a lot of time tracking water levels, tracking the fluctuations in the water levels and all of the different components that cause those fluctuations. And conditions on the Great Lakes over the past 2 years or so have been very interesting. Coming off of the record lows in the system in 2012 and early 2013, immediately following that was the extreme winter of 2013-2014, and the unprecedented rise in water levels that Drew just mentioned that followed. And Drew mentioned that water levels in September, that marked the first time that all the Great Lakes were above average at the same time since the late 1990s. The water levels that I'll refer to are monthly lake-wide mean water levels, and those are tabulated using a network of water level gauges operated by NOAA on the U.S. side and the Canadian Hydrographic Service on the Canadian side, and our period of record for those water levels goes back to 1918. These significant rises that we've seen, especially on Superior and Michigan Huron, have been fueled by very wet conditions across the Great Lakes Basin. An important quantity that we track is called the net basin supply. And the net basin supply is made up of the precipitation that falls directly on the lake surface, the runoff that makes its way into the lake from the surrounding watershed, and then take out the evaporation that occurs from the lake surface. And looking back over the past 2 years or so, 19 of the past 23 months have had an above-average net basin supply on Lake Superior, including the last 10 months in a row. Similarly, on Lake Michigan Huron, the net basin supply has been above average in 18 of the past 23 months and 9 out of the 11 months so far in 2014. And it's this persistent above-average net basin supplies have allowed both Lake Superior and Lakes Michigan Huron to come out of their longest stretch of continuously below average levels since 1918. The November mean water levels for Lake Superior and Lakes Michigan Huron were at their highest level since 1996 and 1997, respectively. Another factor to consider in the system is the wet conditions on Lake Superior have allowed for a much higher outflow of water from Lake Superior into the St. Mary's River, which is another source of water to Lakes Michigan Huron. When Lake Superior rose above average earlier this year, the regulation plan that is used to set outflows called for a higher than average outflow in an attempt to bring the lakes into balance with one another with respect to their long-term average. This outflow, when you average it across the entire year so far in 2014, is the highest outflow since the current regulation plan was implemented in 1990. The Corps in Detroit, in coordination with our counterparts in Environment Canada, released the official six-month coordinated forecast for the Great Lakes. That forecast is called the Monthly Bulletin of Water Levels for the Great Lakes, and that's done at the beginning of each month. The bulletin slides in the slide deck are slide 8 through 12, and I will quickly now go through some of the highlights of the latest forecast, which covers the period December 2014 through May of 2015. Starting with Lake Superior, we are forecasting that water levels will remain anywhere from, in the near term, 9 to 10 inches above those of a year ago, and in a little bit longer term, 2 to 7 inches of above the levels of the year of a year ago, and remain anywhere from 6 to 9 inches above the long-term average. That is still 7 to 9 inches below the record highs, which occurred mostly in the middle 1980s. Moving downstream in the system to Lakes Michigan Huron, we're projecting that Lakes Michigan Huron will remain anywhere from 15 to 21 inches above the levels of 1 year ago and about 7 inches above the long-term average. Again, that is still greater than 2 feet lower than the record highs, again, which were recorded in the middle 1980s. Still moving downstream to Lake St. Clair, we're projecting the levels, again, to remain above average and above those of a year ago. Similarly, on Lakes Erie, above average and above 1 year ago. And then Lake Ontario, which is a regulated lake, there's a fair amount of control over the water levels and the flow in the St. Lawrence River. Slightly below average, below last year, rather, over the next couple months, and then slightly above as we move into the spring, and then very near its long-term average over the next 6 months. So with that, I believe we're going back to Monica, and we'll have some closing remarks, and I think we're opening to questions after that.
Hi, we have Steve now speaking a little bit about some of the new tools.
Sure. Thank you, Monica. So I briefly wanted to introduce you to the Lake Level Viewer product. This product came out by NOAA in October 2014, and it's part of NOAA's Digital Coast Initiative. And it's an online interactive visualization and mapping tool, and it is the companion to an existing sea level rise viewer that covers the U.S. ocean coastline. So it allows users to interact and overlay different water levels upon the land and bathymetric surfaces. The Lake Level Viewer covers the U.S. coastlines for each of the five Great Lakes and the U.S. shorelines and the interconnecting waterways. It uses the best available high-accuracy topographic bathymetric LIDAR data, high-resolution data, to build a digital elevation model. The digital elevation models are often referred to as DEMs for the coastline. Not all of the areas, coastline and the Great Lakes, have coverage yet, and there are some gaps. But the maps, they map lake level elevations at various elevations above and below the long-term averages. There's a scale on this tool that allows you to raise and lower lake levels above and below the long-term averages and look at the changes along the coastline of what might be inundated during high water levels or what might be dry at times of low Great Lakes water levels. It provides also access to the underlying data sets themselves, and it's a very useful screening tool for understanding hazard profiles and vulnerability assessments under various lake level scenarios. We've been talking about some of those extremes just previously. So in the graphic on the slide deck, slide number 16, it's also useful for overlaying various socioeconomic overlays of data onto the topobathy surfaces themselves under a high lake level or low lake level scenario. And this particular lake level view allows you to look at socioeconomic overlays such as the social vulnerability legend, social vulnerability index, which gets to, you know, how well is society able to respond to an extreme water level event, a flooding event, or a dry event. It also looks at economic overlays, such as the number of employees, which gives you a sense of, well, what's going to be affected in terms of our businesses? Where are our businesses concentrated? Are they going to be affected by a certain inundation or high lake level scenario or low lake level scenario? And the other thing that we do with the lake level viewers and the sea level rise viewer is we provide a sense of the estimate of the confidence in the elevation layers themselves. And instead of just taking them at face value, you can sort of understand on a geospatial manner how confident we are in the elevation data. And we know that we need to take that kind of confidence into account before we over-prescribe or over-apply the data sets. We want to make sure that people are fully aware of the context of the confidence in the elevations themselves. So I just wanted to highlight that and urge you to go online and look at that lake level viewer product and look at it in terms of what might be, how it might be used for decision making in the future.
Thanks very much, Steve.
The last component was just to highlight that recently NOAA came out with a National Water Level Observation Gaps Analysis for the Great Lakes. We've done similar gaps analysis for our network in the lower 48 and on the ocean coastlines. But it provides a sense of where we think we have a gap in our network for long-term observations. And the results of the analysis, in short, is that we found three areas where we feel we need to add an additional station. So we're working with our partners on how best to add a new station to cover what we perceive as a gap along the Great Lakes coastline for long-term water level variation data sets. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. Now we'd like to go to the reporter questions. We ask that the working press please identify themselves by name and by their outlet so we have a sense of your geography before asking your question. And I turn it back over to the telephone operator for the reporter questions. And if you have a question.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session with the press. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, for our first question. Our first question is from John Flesher. Your line is open.
Thank you. A couple of things. I first wanted to ask Drew. It sounds like you are sort of declaring officially an end to this period, 15-year period of unusually low water levels. And I wonder if you could say, in addition to the wet conditions we've had, whether the deep freeze that we've had over the last couple of winters, limiting evaporation, may have played a role in that. And secondly, have you ever seen in the record a recovery from a low water period back up to more normal levels or even above normal levels this quickly? I'm wondering how unusual it is for a recovery to happen that fast. And finally, you mentioned that it's hard to forecast, you know, very much farther in advance than 6 months about what the future holds. But anything else you can say about that for people who are wondering, is this the end of the low water period, or is just a little temporary respite?
Right. Thank you, John, for your question. This is Drew Grunewald from NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory responding to that question. First, to address your first question, in terms of the extent to which either limited or even enhanced evaporation has played a role over the past 2 years, I want to start off by saying that measuring evaporation is a challenge. We're very fortunate to have a combination of both models and also a small set of observing platforms out over the middle of the lakes from which we can infer what's happening with evaporation. And what's happened over the past 2 years in general is that evaporation has not played nearly as significant a role as precipitation in these water level surges. However, we have learned something important, which is that with the cold air that has come in, we have observed at these stations extremely high evaporation rates in the late fall and early winter, particularly in December. And interestingly, at periods where ice has either broken up or not yet formed, those high evaporations have continued. However, once the ice has formed in some cases covered some of these stations, we see the evaporation rates drop, mostly due to the ice cover. So in general, there has not been a dramatic departure in evaporation over the past 2 years on a lake-wide average relative to what we believe is the historical average. The second question, John, you had about the rate of recovery. The January 2013 through November 2014 rise on Lake Superior is the highest net rise we have in recorded history on Lake Superior. The rise on Lake Michigan Huron from January 2013 through November 2014 basically ties the previous record that was set for that same 23-month period starting in January with a water level surge in the early 1950s. And then finally, regarding comments on forecasting beyond the six-month range, this enters a time range where it becomes very difficult to forecast water levels. And my colleague, Keith Kompaltowicz, and also my colleague Jim Noel may want to comment more on this. But we enter a range where the major regional meteorological and climatological drivers of precipitation and temperature and wind and evaporation become very difficult to predict. A good example would be the recent Arctic polar vortex anomaly that had a significant impact on the region, but that was not something that was explicitly forecast 6, 7, 8, 9 months in advance.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Tom Henry. Your line is open.
Yeah, I wanted to localize this a little more to Lake Erie, the southernmost lake, and I don't know if Keith had addressed much of Lake Erie. Obviously, what happens in Superior and Michigan and Huron and St. Clair is going to drive what happens in Lake Erie, but being that it's the southernmost lake and not as, you know, and is more vulnerable to climate change and other effects, what, you know, first of all, what specific Lake Erie effects have you noticed and do you anticipate?
Yep. Hi, Tom. This is Keith Kompaltowicz from the Corps of Engineers. One thing that wasn't mentioned in the kind of listing of extreme events that have happened on the Great Lakes was in 2012, Lake Erie was at its highest level in January and had 12 straight months of water level decline. That had never happened in the Lake Erie period of record. It's very rare that Lake Erie does not show some seasonality in terms of rising in the spring, mm-hmm. declining in the fall. So, you know, going back and starting at that extreme event in 2012, the wet conditions that have been experienced on the Great Lakes have also impacted Lake Erie as well. Lake Erie climbed above its long-term average in June of 2013 and has been very near and was very near its average over the next several months and then climbed above average in the spring of 2014. And I can go into some specifics of where Lake Erie is currently and what the forecast is. In November, Lake Erie was 7 inches above its level of 1 year ago and 6 inches above average. And forecasting out over the next 6 months into May of 2015, Lake Erie is expected to remain anywhere from 5 to as many as 11 inches above its levels of a year ago, and 6 to 8 inches above its long-term average.
Okay. And to make these kind of forecasts, this is obviously a very important time of year because winter's coming. How are you, putting on your crystal ball or your hats here and predicting the anticipated precipitation. I mean, what are your thoughts on precipitation? In the case of Lake Erie, I know there's always been, it's been kind of a wild card because of what Drew had mentioned of when, you know, when the lakes are under the most stress is just before they freeze, and with, you know, warmer winter months here for years, and in Ohio the lakes have been freezing, or Erie in particular has been freezing freezing later and so forth, last year being obviously a major exception. But what do you guys anticipate for precipitation and for, you know, for the freeze and when the lake will become hardened enough to seal off evaporation?
Sure. Just a couple of real quick things that the Corps looks at when we're making our forecasts is we certainly use a lot of the information that is put out by NOAA and its subsidiaries, the National Weather Service, the Climate Prediction Center. The Corps also has its own set of statistical analysis that we use. But one thing that's in the slide deck, and maybe Jim Knoll can from the Weather Service can allude to, is the winter outlook for the Great Lakes. Jim, can you address Tom's question by explaining the winter outlook?
Yes, Keith. So this is Jim Knoll here from the NOAA's National Weather Service Ohio River Forecast Center.
Okay.
And what it looks like is this winter will not be like last winter in that some of the drivers that drive the weather across the world, including into the U.S., are ocean patterns. And one of them that currently NOAA's Climate Prediction Center is has us under an El Nino, E-L-N-I-N-O, El Nino
mm-hmm.
watch.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about a 65% chance of that happening this winter into the spring. Now, whether that actually happens or not, it's so marginal that the atmospheric response will be very similar. So the outlook is for either temperatures to be close to or maybe even slightly above normal for this winter across the Great Lakes. And precipitation either about normal or maybe just slightly below normal. And that is opposite of the last 2 years of wet conditions. Whether that continues after this year, you know, in following years, we can't forecast that. But we do not expect as cold or as wet of a winter into the springtime coming up.
Yeah, so in other words, within El Nino, you would anticipate if we have an El Nino that it would be a milder winter or something that, I mean, we're still going to have winter, but it's going to be perhaps much milder than what we anticipated or what we had last year.
Yes, it'll be much closer to normal. So even though it's normal, that's relative to last winter would be definitely warmer, yes.
It won't be unseasonably warm, though, is what you're saying.
Correct. It'll be just either normal or maybe just slightly above normal.
Yeah. And finally, I can't let you guys go because of what happened this year in Toledo. What effect, if any, do you anticipate the extra precipitation or the anticipated precipitation, everything with algae formation next year? The critical time for runoff is, you know, scientists have determined that March 1st through June 30th, which is within your prediction model here for precipitation. That's a critical time for nutrient runoff. And I'm just wondering, in general, I mean, lake levels themselves don't cause algae, but because they're largely reliant on precipitation and or evaporation, how do you anticipate the trend we're in now or your forecast playing into potential algae formation next year?
So, Tom, this is Drew Grunewald from NOAA's Great Lakes Research Laboratory. While we do develop an understanding of precipitation for the effect of what they might do in terms of water levels, The propagation of the precipitation patterns into harmful algal blooms is really outside of the scope of what this group is talking about today. But there are people within our lab and others who we can put you in contact with to better help answer that question.
Okay, but you can't draw any conclusions on you know the dynamics of the water levels, what they'll mean for the formation of HABs in the future then.
I think at this point, yeah, we'd want to turn you back over to Monica for broader guidance on how to navigate those waters, so to speak.
Yeah, okay.
Why don't you get in touch with me afterwards, and we'll see if there's some ways for us to respond. But the team that we have today, the group of experts that we have today, are focused on the water levels and not so much the ecosystem effects that on that front.
Yeah.
We'll take the next question now. Thanks very much, Tom.
Okay.
Our next question is from Don Hopi. Your line is open.
Hi. What are the particular benefits or problems that could be caused by the rising water levels on the Great Lakes and at the levels that you're predicting? And on which of the lakes would those types of things or the water level have the biggest impact? And also, just one other thing, are these changes part of normal fluctuation, or do you have you done any type of study as to whether or not we're looking at a climate change impact on lake levels?
All right, great. This is Keith Kompaltowicz with the Corps of Engineers. And some of the impacts that we are seeing in terms of stories in the media and phone calls we get from stakeholders is there is some growing concern about shoreline erosion. Folks saw a very quick increase in water level, which in some places meant a very quick decrease in the amount of beach in front of their property. So we have seen some instances of significant shoreline erosion, especially with the Halloween storm that really caused some large wave action and some erosion on Lake Michigan. So that's one kind of a negative impact. Coming off of the significant low and record low water levels, the concern in the commercial navigation industry was the ability to carry large cargo on vessels, and with the low water levels, vessels had to light load or not carry up to their full capacity. And with the recent surge in water levels, now that we are above average across the board, the lake carriers, the large boats that carry cargo on the lakes are now able to load much more and hence make less trips to deliver the same amount of cargo. An interesting stat, just recently on November 21st, the navigation lock in Sault Ste. Marie that the Corps of Engineers runs and operates, the largest lock is the Poe. It set a daily tonnage record. No day since the Poe was put in service has the tonnage sent through that lock been greater than November 21st. So while all of that can't be attributed to the rise in water level, certainly navigation interests are carrying much more cargo now than they have over the past several years, especially during the period of low water levels. Whether or not this has been seen before in history, if it's normal fluctuation, so on and so forth, we've alluded to a couple times that on Superior and Michigan Huron, we haven't seen two-year water level increases of this magnitude going back through the period of record. However, we are not outside the recorded range of water levels yet. The record highs are still quite a bit higher on Lake Superior and Lake Michigan Huron. So while the recovery has not been recorded in such a fashion in history, we are still not outside the recorded history of water levels when you look at record highs and record lows.
Thanks.
As a reminder, to ask a question, You can press star 1 and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. Our next question is from Jim Block. Your line is open.
Writing from the southern tip of Lake Huron. Over the last 15 years or so, it seems that climate change has had the opposite impact on the lakes and the oceans, with, you know, the oceans rising and coastal communities being threatened. And in the Great Lakes, maybe coastal communities seeing increased beaches and that sort of thing. I'm wondering if the lakes and the oceans are getting in sync somehow now, or if you could just comment on the relationship between lakes and oceans and climate change.
So this is Drew Grunewald from NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory responding to that question for starters. In general, it's complicated to identify any strong linkage between marine coastal water level patterns over long time periods and Great Lakes water level patterns. Although one thing we do point out is that the Great Lakes have an extremely long coastline. There's roughly 10,000 miles of coastline in the Great Lakes system. So from that perspective, we are dealing with large-scale coastal issues. However, when it comes to Great Lakes water level fluctuations along that coastline, we're talking about a very subtle interplay between the amount of precipitation in the system and the amount of water that's lost through evaporation and evapotranspiration in the system. And it's a balance between those two components that can lead to long-term declines or long-term increases in water levels. Unlike, for example, similar situations on the marine coast where they're dealing with sea level rise, or they're dealing with, in some cases, the landscape receding or rising due to changes in glacial melt. So they're in a large way, they're very different drivers of water level change on those two different types of coastal systems.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from TJ Pignataro. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Buffalo, New York, from Buffalo News, and a couple of questions, more or less about, you know, looking on Lake Erie again. What does all of this mean for regular people? I mean, are there regular, or is there like recreational implications that are in play when the water levels are higher? Is it something where at this end of the lake we tend to get, you know, the seiche when the wind it hits just right? So are we talking about increased problems with flooding potentially? Come next spring, what are people going to notice that might be different from last year? Is it the high water marks going to be higher, or, you know, when we get into April, May, and the beach sort of season?
Yep. Hi, TJ. This is Keith Kompaltowicz from the Corps of Engineers. In looking at what we're forecasting, as we head into the spring months, we're looking at water levels on Lake Erie, anywhere 5 to 11 inches higher than they were at the same time in the spring of 2014. So what people will notice is if they have a boat at a marina, the boat might be sitting a little higher next to their dock. You know, when water levels were low, they may have needed a ladder to climb down into their boat. With higher water levels now, maybe the ladder is needed to get into their boat going upwards. People that own lakefront property with higher water levels in this coming spring will notice less beach. And when you do see that seiche effect on Lake Erie, when we get sustained southwest winds, the water levels as a result in Buffalo could, yes, be higher, which could lead to some coastal flooding. Those are kind of a simple way to look at some of the impacts, but, for folks that are recreational boaters with higher water levels, access is improved, so to speak, across the Great Lakes. You can access maybe a different harbor that wasn't able to accommodate the specific boat that you had. Maybe you can get into a bay or a protected inlet if you're a fisherman that you may not have been able to get into over the past. So those are some of the, you know, the impacts that recreational boaters and shoreline property owners might see.
Mm-hmm. As a follow-up to it, when we were talking about, I think we were on a conference call maybe a year and a half ago about the low record or the low levels, and now we're talking about highs. And it's kind of remarkable that it's happened so quickly. What do you make of the trends? Is it just about the snow and rainfall runoff, or is it that 92.5% ice figure from last year? How much did that play into it? And if you could restate, somebody had mentioned some stats earlier about Superior and Michigan, Huron, the precipitation stats for the last, 10 months, I think. How much has all of that played into this dramatic rise?
Certainly, I think the rise that we've seen can really be directed to precipitation and runoff. You know, those are the two quantities that we have seen, and Drew can follow up. You know, when we look at the methods that we have to measure and estimate those quantities, we certainly see larger runoff and precipitation values over the past, you know, 2 years that have fed this rise. And those that stats that I read earlier were about the net basin supply of water to the lakes. And that, again, is a measure of the precipitation that falls on the lake surface, runoff from the surrounding watershed, and then takes into account the evaporation that leaves the lake surface. And for Lake Superior, and TJ, I can follow up with specific net basin supply values for Lake Erie, but mm-hmm. on Lake Superior, 19 of the last 23 months have had above average net basin supply, including the last 10 in a row. And on Lakes Michigan and Huron, the net basin supply has been above average 18 out of the past 23 months and 9 out of the months so far in 2014. And TJ, I can follow up with you with similar statistics for Lake Erie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Dan Cracker. Your line is open.
Hi, and this was maybe covered in the last question, but could you talk about how much of a role the substantial ice cover played, if any, in the rise in lake levels? And then as a follow-up to that, that was obviously an anomaly with climate change. You know, I mean, the ice levels have already decreased dramatically since 1970, and that trend is expected to continue. Do you know, I mean, what impact and what role do you think that will have with water levels as we move forward into the future?
So, hi, good question. This is Drew Grunewald from NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory responding to your call. The story of ice and the interplay between ice and water levels is somewhat of a complicated one, but we quite often, in some regards, look at the ice formation as the timing, the onset, and the thickness of ice as a consequence of one of the drivers of water level change, mainly in terms of temperature changes, rather than an explicit driver of water level change. One interesting perspective on this, following up with what Keith just said, is that over the past 2 years, starting in January 2013, we've had very similar seasonal patterns in water level rise, where we've seen these significant surges in the spring, below average declines in the fall. And across both of those years, we've seen a consistent linkage to above average precipitation, despite the fact that in only one of those 2 years did we have the high ice cover and the Arctic polar vortex anomaly. So that really, I think, underscores, at least within this two-year period, the significance of precipitation in the region as a driver of water level change relative to what's happened regarding ice and evaporation changes. That's not to say that the formation of ice last winter wasn't startling and significant. It just has to do with the lake-wide average impacts on evaporation in light of that ice formation weren't as significant as the changes we've seen in precipitation over the past 2 years.
Thanks.
We do have a question from Tom Henry. Your line is open.
I know this probably isn't your cup of tea in terms of taking policy implication questions, but you know, it seems to me if you're going to have a gradual rise in water levels that that'll affect the coastal wetlands too, which you know have been hotly disputed through confusing Supreme Court challenges. You're probably familiar. The U.S. EPA is trying to come up with definitions that will somehow satisfy everybody over wetlands and you know where a ditch and a stream begin and also just the whole pressure, legal pressure on beachfront property with less beachfront it may potentially have an impact on property values or you know the disputes between property owners and the state-owned water. But I just wondered if you guys had any thoughts on just in terms of the impacts of water levels, how that could affect wetlands and the ongoing dispute over you know what are wetlands and also the pressure on beachfront property.
Hi, this is Deborah Lee with the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. The questions you pose are very interesting, but NOAA's mission is to provide the best science and the best research available to formulate policy. And so we really can't address any regulatory questions. That falls in the realm of some of our sister agencies. But if you like, we can get more information to you on who to pose that question to after the call.
Okay. And then another thing I mentioned earlier, and I know Rick Stump at NOAA is probably your best algae guy, but since somebody had mentioned the possibility of more shoreline erosion, whether it's algae nutrients or not, that's often a underrated impact is water pollution from erosion. And is there any way of anticipating how much more erosion you might have because of these rising water levels?
Tom, this is Keith Compulsis from the Corps. I don't, unfortunately.
Okay. And maybe Drew might want to speak to this or anyone else, but just getting back to the I know we can't go much more than the next 6 months, but given your history and everyone's history looking at the water levels, the trends, you know, Frank Quinn used to tell me that they would go in about 30-year averages or so forth, but this everyone always says this is a new era, that you can't rely on past records to predict the future right now, and how unstable in this era of climate change are these type of trends, do you believe? I mean, this remarkable recovery that you're talking about, some people are probably forgetting it's only 2 years removed from the 2012 drought that was the worst drought in 50 years. And it just seems like, you know, to go from the worst drought in 50 years to now having being very stable water is a good thing to a lot of people, but yet to expect it's going to stay this way for the next 15, 20 years seems like it may be asking a lot.
This is Drew from NOAA's Great Lakes Lab. I'd like to call upon our colleague Jim Noel to maybe help address your question within the context of changes in climate variability and those types of oscillations. Jim, are you available?
Yeah, thanks, Drew. Yeah, again, this is Jim Noel here at the NOAA's National Weather Service Ohio River Forecast Center. One of the things that we look at is when we do have a warming climate system that generally increases storm frequency across North America, from research that we've done. And the bottom line is what that yields is greater variability from year to year. And so back in the first half of last century, from the 1900s up to the 1950s, we had far more variability and shifts going on, and that relaxed some in the second half of that century. As we get into a warmer environment here overall, storm frequency increases. So it is not, shall I say, it is not surprising that we would see a more rapid changes and shift back and forth, like we've seen at times in past climates.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's certainly a risk going forward.
Okay. What about, and I've heard before, although this is only a six-month window of time, you can't deduce too much from that, but that, you know, at some point, the greater precipitation will be negated by the warmer climate. That doesn't, in your modeling, that doesn't appear to be the case because you're anticipating a rise in water levels. But, you know, is there a point in time in which, even with, you know, the greater frequency of storms, which has, you know, been documented since the 60s here in the Great Lakes region and apparently is continuing to occur, that that the warmer climate could negate those, you know, and that your net increase in water may not be as much as you anticipate, in, you know, at some point in the future.
So, Tom, this is Drew Grunewald from NOAA's Great Lakes Research Laboratory. The various models that have been run that look at long-term projections of changes in climate around the Great Lakes region really reflect exactly what you're talking about, the subtle interplay between increases in precipitation and increases in temperature, and different representations of how changes in temperature can affect evaporation and evapotranspiration lead to differences in whether or not water levels might go up or whether they might go down. So it really is a challenging question to answer, and it's not very straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just thought I'd throw it out there, let you guys take a crack at it, but appreciate your comments.
Our last question is from John Slusher. Your line is open.
Thank you. I just wanted to... Keith, you mentioned that you might be able to provide those numbers with regard to Lake Erie on the net basin supply and the number of months in a row where that had been the case. I wanted to get those figures, too, if you had them handy.
I don't have them with me, John. I will follow up with you after the call.
Would you? I'd appreciate it.
Yep, no problem.
I want to thank everybody for joining the call today. This is Monica Allen again from NOAA Communications. And if you have any follow-up questions, I urge you to call me at 301-734-1123. My email is also a good way to reach me at Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A, dot Allen, A-L-L-E-N, at NOAA.gov. And we have three other things I wanted to point out where there's some resources for you. We have online tools and links to bulletins and various reports. And that is in your slide deck, page 15. And if you need that slide deck, please email me and I'll email you that. Also, we have a web story that's running and summarizing some of the high points of the Great Lakes water levels issues that we talked about today. And that is at www.oar.noaa.gov. That's up online right now. And also, we will be posting a recording of this call soon, and it will be on both the GLURL, the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab site, probably on where the slide deck is, and I'll also post it on the web story that's going up on oar.noaa.gov. So I thank you all very much, and I thank our experts today. We look forward to talking with you again.
And this now concludes today's conference. All participants may disconnect at this time.